The movie moguls who built the major studios, MGM, Columbia, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Fox, and Universal, had something in common beyond movies. They were all Eastern European Jews. Film critic Neil Gabler has written a collective biography of these immigrants who built the film industry. Gabler is the former co-host of the PBS movie review show Sneak Previews. His new book opens with a paradox. The movies that created our images of America were actually made by Jewish immigrants who didn't fit into the dreams that they themselves created.
Well, the interesting thing, I think, about the individuals who created the motion picture industry, that first generation of so-called moguls, Adolf Zukor and Harry Cohn and Louis B. Mayer and the Warner Brothers and Carl Emley, was that though they are almost always characterized in history and indeed exist in our imaginations as vulgarians with gold pinky rings and a men of absolute, of no education, no culture. Quite the contrary, in fact, was true in terms of their aspirations. Oddly enough, though, as I say, we characterize them as vulgarians, and though they are often regarded as the villains in the history of the movies, and by some the villains of history of in the history of American culture generally, these were men who desperately wanted, by and large, to enter those hallowed precincts of genteel American aristocracy. Most of them came to the United States and settled in the East, and they had their eyes cocked toward the Eastern aristocracy. But they were proscribed from entering those precincts because they were Jewish, because they were uneducated, because they didn't have the style that the genteel and Gentile aristocracy required.
Your book kind of asks the question, why is it that the Jews who ran the film industry made movies in which there were no Jews? When did you start wondering about that question?
Well, that question came later, I think. The initial question was, I mean, here is a fact, that the motion picture industry was created by and operated by a remarkably homogeneous group of individuals, these Eastern European Jews, whose names we discussed. And yet, that fact exists almost nowhere in American film history. I use the term in the book, or the phrase, that they were the phantoms of film history. They could haunt it, but they couldn't operate within it. And that issue came first for me. The issue of, here are these individuals, all of whom were Eastern European Jews. What effect did that have on them psychologically? In what way did that component move them into the movie industry? And the other issues, the issue of, you know, Jewish presence in the motion pictures and whatever, came after that initial issue.
You said that this is a subject that hadn't really come up in the history of movies. Why do you think it's a subject that went unaddressed for so long?
Partly because it's a very, very sensitive subject, Terry. Even I encountered this when I was researching the book. I encountered individuals, obviously most of the people I interviewed for the book were Jewish, many of them family members of the individuals about whom I was writing. And when I discussed the book, I heard frequently, do you really want to write a book like this? Is a book like this necessary? Some people simply wouldn't talk to me because they felt I would be opening a can of worms and creating fodder for anti-Semites. So I think partly there was that element that this is a subject that can only be used in a negative way, only be used by anti-Semites, so why raise it? And I think, quite frankly, there's another side to this, that people didn't regard it as important, that people didn't regard the moguls necessarily as important. The history of film is essentially, the way it's been written up to this point, is essentially the history of the directors and the writers and the stars. It's not the history of the executives who ran the studios and, in my opinion, set the agenda. This isn't to say that the role of the director, the star, the writer, whatever, is a negligible one. It was a very important one. But it is to say that the executives had an equally, if not more, significant role. MGM is MGM because of Louis B. Mayer, not necessarily because of the stars and directors who worked there. The stars and directors worked there because Louis B. Mayer hired them.
Okay, you mentioned Louis B. Mayer. Give us just a thumbnail sketch of his Eastern European background and how he came to America.
Well, Louis B. Mayer, though he was very loath to discuss his origins, was born in Russia, came to the United States, actually came to Canada first. and settled in St. John with his father, who was a junk man. And he moved from St. John to Boston, where he really was rather shiftless individual, had a very difficult time finding a position for himself. And almost by accident, because he'd been doing errands at a local theater, he got wind of an available theater in Haverhill, Massachusetts. And Mayer went there, rented the theater, and used that theater in Haverhill as a means of rehabilitating himself, really. He became the entrepreneur of Haverhill, Massachusetts. And from there, he moved into theatrical production and ultimately into film production.
That's a route that several of the moguls took, going from exhibition to distribution to production. Why was that such a common route?
Several reasons, Terry. I mean, one is that it required very little capital. You could set up a theater for a very small amount of money. In the case of Louis B. Mayer, I think the rental of the theater and the equipment was something like $600. Adolf Zukor, I think, spent something like $400 on outfitting his theater. So there were very few economic barriers to enter exhibition. But another reason was that I think the Jews had, this group of Jews, had a particular sensitivity to the public, a sensitivity that they could indulge and exercise an exhibition. Many of these individuals came from other professions prior to moving into the motion picture industry. For example, Adolf Zukor was a furrier, and he had a sensitivity to taste of necessity.
Zukor is the founder of Paramount.
That's right. Well, not really the founder of Paramount Pictures. A man by the name of Hodkinson actually founded Paramount Pictures, but it was very shortly after Hodkinson founded it that Adolf Zukor took over the company, and Adolf Zukor was responsible for making Paramount Pictures into the major film entity that it ultimately became.
My guest is Neil Gabler, the film critic who's the author of the new book, An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood, and it's basically the story of the film moguls who started the Hollywood movie industry. You point out that some of these Eastern European Jews who started the film industry in America were able to get a foothold in the movie business because movies were viewed suspiciously by the economic establishment, by the financial establishment. Movies were seen to be something that could undermine moral values. Describe what the climate was like and why movies were seen suspiciously.
It's not only by the financial establishment, but equally by the social and moral establishments. The motion pictures, movies very early in this century, were regarded first as a novelty, as something that would last for a very short time, that no one of any real serious interest would get involved in, that should be left to individuals like Jews and Irishmen and whatever, because this was a fly-by-night business. But very shortly after the introduction of movies, in fact, by 1905, 1906, 1907, when the Nickelodeon sprung up, which was essentially storefront theaters with, outfitted with chairs, the custodians of the moral order, the prevailing social order, realized that the movies were having a tremendous influence on individuals in this country, particularly working class individuals and immigrants, who were the primary audience for the first motion pictures. And when that happened, their first response was to launch a crusade against the movies and what they regard as the deleterious effects of the movies on that audience. And in fact, there was an anti-Semitic component ultimately in this crusade, because why, the question had to be asked, why would anyone or who would undermine the prevailing social order? Who would subvert traditional American values? And of course the answer was, well, immigrants, people who don't understand America. And it was a very short jump from accusing immigrants of subverting American values to accusing Jews, who at that time were exhibiting movies and ultimately would be producing and distributing movies.
But you point out that even the darkened theater was considered an environment that could breed iniquity.
You're right, Terry. In fact, we have to use our sympathetic imaginations to get back to the movie-going experience at the turn of the century and actually up through the teens. Today, the movie-going experience is something very different. But in those days, I mean, you go into a darkened theater. The audience was primarily women and children. You'd eat peanuts and fruit and whatever during the movie. It was a very democratic experience. You'd talk during the movie. Now, obviously, the movies were silent, although there was musical accompaniment. And afterwards, When you left the movie house, I describe a passage in the book from an editorial in The Nation, titled, the editorial was titled, A Democratic Art. And afterwards, as that editorial describes, you know, individuals would discuss the movies, talk about them with great seriousness. I mean, the movies very quickly became an important part of the cultural lives of immigrants and working class individuals in this country. In a way that obviously Thomas Edison, who took credit for inventing the movies, and other Gentiles in no way could have anticipated, but in a way that the Jews, who exhibited movies and were ultimately to produce movies, did anticipate. And it was their real strength in, if you want to use the term, in conquering the movie industry.
How do you think the personality traits of the individual studio owners were reflected in the studios that they built and in the kind of movies that they made? Maybe you could give us a couple of examples.
Some of these things are very subtle, and some aren't. I mean, in the case of the Warner Brothers, I think it's not very subtle. Jack Warner, who was the head of production of the studio, essentially, was a kind of rapscallion. He disavowed anything Jewish, disavowed anything European. He regarded himself as an American, born and bred. And the movies reflected a kind of urbanized, underclass quality that anyone who enjoys Warner Brothers pictures would recognize instantly. Even the stars at Warner Brothers reflected Jack Warner in a way. Humphrey Bogart and Cagney and Betty Davis. These weren't the aestheticized figures that you find in the movies of Paramount or of MGM. I mean, these were battlers. These were people on the margins. So I would say that, you know, Warner Brothers movies romanticized outsiders because the Warners themselves regarded themselves as outsiders, outside the Hollywood establishment, outside the American establishment. On the other hand, Paramount Pictures, and the studio, as we mentioned, was run by Adolph Zukor. He set the agenda for that studio, had a kind of continental sheen. The great stars of Paramount, you think of Maurice Chevalier and Cary Grant, who worked there frequently. There was something very sophisticated, very Tony, about the movies of Paramount, which reflected Adolf Zukor's aspirations. There's something very European about the films of Paramount. And many of the stars and many of the directors, Ernst Lubitsch being perhaps the primary example, were European. MGM, on the other hand, had a kind of schizophrenic quality. On the one hand, there was the glamorous Grand Hotel element of MGM, best typified, I think, by Greta Garbo. On the other hand, there was that domestic side of MGM, best exemplified by Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney in the Andy Hardy pictures. And those reflected two sides of Louis B. Mayer. On the one hand, Mayer with his aspirations to opulence and to grandeur, and on the other hand, the kind of puritanical little Louis Mayer who believes so fervently in moral values. And that's reflected, as I say, in the Andy Hardy pictures.
Columbia was sometimes called Poverty Row because they operated on such skimpy budgets and underpaid, or were reluctant to pay. I'm not sure which.
Both. Harry Cohn, who ran Columbia, yes, was very reluctant to pay decent salaries.
Oh, and I think one writer called it the equivalent of a police state. Describe a little bit what the atmosphere was like at Columbia in the early days, and what, if anything, you think that had to say about Harry Cohn, who ran the studio.
Well, it had a lot to say about Harry Cohn. Harry Cohn, as I describe him in the book, waged a war against the world. Though he did have certain genteel aspirations, like Louis B. Mayer and Adolph Zukor and several of the others, on the other hand, Cohn saw himself as a kind of naked aggressor in a world of naked aggressors. The term I use in the book, I say, in a world of prostitutes, he wanted to be the procurer. And he ran the studio very much that way. There's a great story, and I heard this several times, about the way Harry Cohn operated. You'd come to him with a story idea or whatever, and Cohn would say no, without even listening. And if you took that no, you'd never get anything done at the studio. On the other hand, if after Cohn said no, you argued. You said, but Harry, I want to tell you something. This is why I think it'll work, and on and on and on. Cohn would almost always give in. I mean, Cohn operated the studio essentially as a test of one's mettle. And if you had that mettle, as Frank Capra, the most famous director at Columbia, did, you succeeded. And if you didn't, you could never succeed there. Cohn wanted a battle, and he believed that the best art came out of a kind of contentiousness. And he was certainly contentious. You use the term police state. I mean, he would watch his writers. The writers were arrayed around a kind of quadrangle at the old Columbia. And Cohn could look out his window into their offices and see who was typing and who wasn't. And he'd phone them if they weren't typing and say, "You're not typing." As if, you know, the job of a writer was to sit at a typewriter. Any contemplation was verboten. But that was the way that Harry Cohn operated. And, you know, though in the history of Hollywood, he's regarded as something like a, pariah, the most anti-art, you know, mogul of them all. On the other hand, you look at the pictures that Columbia produced, the great pictures of Frank Capra and some of the great comedies of George Stevens, and there are some really extraordinary films there. And I think it's because, though Cohn was a difficult man for whom to work, on the other hand, he was a very, very supportive employer if you believed in yourself. He believed in you.
It's great because you're describing this police state and Capra's making these populist movies.
That's right. And Capra didn't, the irony wasn't lost on Frank Capra either.
My guest is film critic Neil Gabler, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. And the book is a study of the first film moguls, the moguls who ran the early film studios, and most of these moguls were Jewish. So Gabler's book investigates what Judaism meant in their lives and how, if at all, it affected the movies they made and the studios they ran. We'll talk more after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Neil Gabler is my guest, and you might remember him as a former co-host of the public television movie review show, Sneak Previews. I think a lot of us know by now that Paul Muni's real name was, what, Muni Wiesenfeld?
That's correct. Wiesenfreund.
Wiesenfreund. And a lot of the actors got very anglicized or Americanized names, actors who had very ethnic names, Polish, Italian, Jewish. Did the studio heads have anything to do with that decision?
Very much so. In regard to Jewish actors particularly, there was an incredible sensitivity. The idea was that Jews should be seen and not heard. And someone like Paul Muni is a perfect example. His life in some ways is a symbol of the way in which the Jewish actor was treated in Hollywood. He was always wrapped in someone else's ethnicity. He could never be a Jew or never play himself, in fact. And I have a story in the book from a close friend of Muni's that Muni would even answer the door in makeup because he had so far erased his own identity. And his tragedy is essentially, writ large, the tragedy of the other Jewish performers. Edward G. Robinson could play an Italian, but not a Jew. Ethnicity was something that was looked on askance by most of the Jewish moguls. After all, ethnicity was the very thing they were trying to escape. The very thing they were trying to establish is this idea that there is an America, this homogenized America with a set of traditional values. And although the Warner Brothers depart somewhat from that, they don't depart from the sense of America. Theirs is a slightly different version of America, but it's an America in which there is, essentially a middle-class, white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant population, and that ethnics, shine shoes and perform and commit crimes as they do in the Warner Brothers movies, but they don't do a lot more than that.
Well, I wonder how much you think that is a result of the desire to assimilate on the part of the Jews who ran the industry, and how much of it was just good demographic sense, that there weren't that many Jews in America compared to, say, other ethnic groups, and if they made movies about Jews, maybe they wouldn't sell as well at the box office.
I think, Terry, it's partly both. I think, one, obviously they always had their eye on the box office. On the other hand, I think that the last thing they wanted to do is to create in the public consciousness a sense that Jews, foreigners, whatever, subversives, were running the industry. They lived in the constant fear From the time that they took over the industry to the time they left it, they lived in the constant fear that somehow it would all be taken away from them. Because, in fact, as I mentioned earlier, I mean, very early on there was a campaign with an anti-Semitic tinge that somehow the movies were subverting American values because Jews were running them. And then into the 30s, there was a Legion of Decency, which essentially was promulgating the same idea that the movies were subverting American values and had to be cleaned up. And then, of course, you have HUAC and the Blacklist and all the things that happened in the 40s, which had, as I indicate in the book, the perspective I take on that situation in the book, is that there was very definitely an anti-Semitic quality to Representative Martin Dias and others who ran that committee, and that it wasn't simply a matter of cleaning up the movies, but at least as the film executives perceived it, it was also a matter of cleaning up the executives who ran the movies and putting real Americans in those positions. So I think the idea somehow that the men who ran the movies weren't real Americans was something that terrified the Hollywood moguls, the Jewish moguls. And they did their best to portray themselves as real Americans, full-fledged aristocratic Americans. And they created their own aristocracy out in California.
But you describe how when big finance moved in and invested in the film industry, that gradually fewer and fewer Jews were represented on the board of directors of the major studios.
That's true. I mean, Wall Street money moves into the motion picture industry fairly early, as soon as they realized that it wasn't a novelty, in fact, but that it was very central to the American cultural life. And as that happens, gradually, over the years, and accelerated during the Depression, when, contrary to popular belief, I mean, the motion pictures industry did not weather the Depression as well as, you know, one might think. Everyone thinks of, you know, Americans going to the movies throughout the Depression and laughing their cares away, and that really was not the way it happened. In fact, almost every major studio, with the exception of MGM, either was in receivership or was in very dire financial straits. So gradually, and accelerated by the Depression, Wall Street money and Wall Street, you know, individuals moved into the companies and onto the boards, and as that happened, the power of the Hollywood Jews diminished. Also, they got older, and the power diminished because of that. And other economic changes took place in the industry, television and its incursions. The Justice Department won a consent decree from the motion picture industry to divorce exhibition from distribution and production, and that changed the motion picture industry. And so all of these things ultimately contributed to breaking up what I regarded as kind of monarchies. I mean, MGM, Paramount, Warner Brothers, Columbia, Universal, all of these things were monarchies in which the Jewish moguls were the monarchs. And as all of these other forces came into play over the years, by the early 1950s, the monarchies were beginning to crumble.
How much do you think that the personal imprint of the monarchs still remains?
Not very much today. I think that the studio today obviously is a very different creature. The studio today is essentially a financing and distribution mechanism. The people who wield the real power in Hollywood are the stars and the directors, not the executives. And in fact, the one individual who did try to run a studio in recent Hollywood history, the way that a Louis B. Mayer ran MGM, was David Putnam at Columbia. I mean, Putnam really had a philosophy that Columbia's movies ought to have a special imprint, that they ought to have a special quality. And you saw what happened to David Putnam. I mean, he had a very, very brief run as a Columbia executive, largely because I think you can't run a studio that way any longer.
I want to quote something, or that is paraphrase something that Pauline Kael once wrote. She said that the balance between art and commerce is always a precarious one, but in the movie industry, at least movies were in the hands of businessmen who love the movies, but now that conglomerates have taken over, that's no longer the case. I wonder if you'd agree with that, and what you think that finally means in the way that movies have been affected.
I would certainly agree with the first part of it. I mean, the men I write about in my book loved movies passionately, every single one of them. I mean, to the point where I have that story between the confrontation between Frank Capra and Harry Cohn. And Harry Cohn Capra is bringing a lawsuit against Conan. I won't go into the details. The important thing is the punchline. Cohn saying, getting on his hands and knees, essentially, in front of Capra and crying and saying, Columbia is my life. It may mean nothing to you, but it's everything to me. And I think that attitude actually characterized the attitude of almost all the individuals I write about. The movies were their lives. They loved movies passionately, and I think it's one of the reasons that they made the kinds of movies they did, movies that have endurance, movies that we look at today and enjoy. I'm not so sure about the second half of that equation. It's very easy to kind of throw brickbats at the executives in Hollywood today, and some of them certainly deserve it. But it's been my own personal experience that there are many executives in Hollywood who love movies almost as passionately as the men who ran the studios. I think the difference is that in those days, you had to love them that passionately. There was no other choice. You couldn't run a studio any other way. And today, there is a choice. I mean, you don't have to love the movies that way. You don't have to have any sense of movie history. You simply have to know how to make a deal. It's a matter of requirement rather than a matter of result, I think.
You make the case in your book that part of what drove the Jewish movie moguls into this Gentile vision of America was the desire to assimilate and to not be accused of being outsiders running the film industry. But on the other hand, everything was so airbrushed in the movies. I mean, everybody was perfected in a way so that nobody would really recognize themselves on screen. Do you know what I mean? Do you think that perhaps you've overemphasized the drive of assimilation?
I don't think so, Terry, because what you're describing is something that was the consequence of the men who ran the studios. Remember that they take over the studios in the late teens, and they govern the motion picture industry, this small group of individuals, through the 20s, 30s, 40s, and even into the 50s. So that what you're describing, this kind of sanitized version of American life, in which almost everyone is airbrushed, is a consequence of the Hollywood Jews' control of the industry.
Neil Gabler, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Neil Gabler has been my guest. He's a film critic who you might, by the way, remember from his three seasons as the co-host of Sneak Previews on public television. His new book is called An Empire of Their Own, How the Jews Invented Hollywood. It's published by Crown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.